is it to discourse? It can only be millennial. And now here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello, but first I'm going to play this one.
I have returned. After an eternity away from you all, Jack the Raven is back.
Hello. Very interesting atmospheric intro video there. I'm here with Jack from Staffordshire Folklore. Jack, welcome to Millennial, and would you like to introduce yourself?
Hello, yes, I'm Jack Raven. I run Staffordshire Folklore, a small YouTube channel that talks about folklore. For those of you who are from England, some of you may know where Staffordshire is. For those of you who are overseas, let me help you out a little bit. I'm sure you've heard of Birmingham. It's infamous. Staffordshire is a county that is just north and to the northwest of Birmingham. It encompasses several regions. Down south, we've got the Black Country, which is where it's the birthplace of the Industrial Revolution. Up towards the centre, we're mainly forest, the Forest of Cannock Chase, which is the remains of an ancient forest of Mercia, and to the north, Stoke-on-Trent, which is the home of the potteries industry. So we've got a good mix of things there. We have a lot of things in history that are separate us out as a county, including the fact that we're linked to the Gunpowder Plot with Guy Fawkes. This is where it was kind of planned and where they retreated to afterwards when it didn't work. This is where the perpetrators were hunted down to and eventually caught. A lot of that isn't appreciated today.
No. Yeah, I never knew that.
Yeah, so one of the videos I've done previously was on that, about Gideon Grove, who's a ghost associated with the house where those perpetrators were caught.
Yeah. Right, I see. Okay, well, would you like to introduce your YouTube channel and the things that you do before we get into the actual meat of this?
So the main thing I do is I look for old stories from the county, and I take them, I research them, I try and find things that people haven't pointed out before in more modern books, and then I present it in a way that's a bit entertaining. I do light animation in a very 2D style. If you've seen Murdoch, I think that's a very close approximation of the kind of thing that I do. I use the Raven as a bit of an avatar for that. But there's other things I do as well on second channels, including interviews with people who are older and have memories about the county. And I also try and save historic footage, documentaries. And I've done a lot of work trying to save folk music as well. I've traced down several folk musicians that are much lesser known from the folk revival. They're very old now. They're going to pass away, and a lot of their stuff is digitized, and I've been digitizing and uploading their stuff to the internet for them to help preserve it for future generations.
That's incredible, good work, and very worthy. I've sort of been getting into this kind of thing myself over the last year or so with my Substack, with researching the history of various things, but including my hometown. And I don't know how interesting it will be to other people, but because they don't know the town as intimately as I know it, obviously. But for me, it's fascinating to think that that building used to not be there. There used to be a building there that the people knew, like for hundreds of years, the people knew that building, but now it's gone. And the thing I know is a different version of the town, you know. It's all very interesting, but for me, at least, it's fascinating, perhaps especially because I'm not there anymore. So it's
one of the things that interests me the most is how we understand the world around us, how we understand our communities and our environments. And buildings are one of the many facets of that. So ancient historic buildings, we've got a few in Staffordshire. We've got the Oak House, which was just upgraded to grade one. That's a little bit of a little minor win. But we've had a lot that have been lost, unfortunately. If anyone's been following my channel, you'll know that we've lost the Crooked House in the last couple of years. That was all over the news. It was an ancient historic pub that was famously on the skew, and it was burned down in what's quite heavily suspected to be arson. And that's a lot of heritage that's been lost, and the community response to that proves what you're saying about how important these things are to people.
Oh, it absolutely does. And this is the thing, that a place changes, and once the change has happened, it might leave a scar, or it might be invisible, so that you, future generations, don't even know of this thing that was very familiar to everyone who lived there. It's a very strange part of it all. But anyway, I don't want to get into my own stuff, because that's not what this is all about. Why don't you start with what you were going to talk about, folklore, what it is, and the dangers to it in this day and age. So let's start with, well, what do you mean by folklore? Define it in your own terms, your own way.
Thank you very much. Yeah, it will be in my own terms, because I think every folklorist might give you a slightly different answer. It was famously coined in 1846 by Mr. W. J. Toms, and the previous expression was sort of like popular antiquities or natural history. Folklore, most people will understand, it's people knowledge, it's things that people have learned, but that's not actually very helpful, because by that definition, that's very broad. Anything could be the knowledge of the people, including train timetables and boiling point of water. So I think you need to take a little bit of a different approach to that and say it's not the learning of people, the knowledge of people. It has to be a people or the people, particularly a community that has a self-identity. Now, historically, this would always be a region-based area, because that's how communities were. They were always region-locked. But not necessarily, because there were a couple of communities that were exceptions to that rule. The boatsmen who worked on the canals, they went up and down the country, and they were a self-identifying community, but also gypsies as well have their own folklore. You also have to zoom in and out of it a little bit, because you can say the folklore of England, you can say the folklore of Staffordshire, or the folklore of the Black Country. You can also say the folklore of Africa or the folklore of China. But these things don't tend to interact with each other very much. So you have to specify the community and the granularity of which you're doing it, because otherwise it's just not a useful term at all. An important thing about that is that it does tie sort of to a region, in that new communities who come to that region won't necessarily share it, because they're not part of the identifying group. So when you've got these places like Warsaw, Birmingham, London, where there were, they were always English communities, and then other populations have come into them, those populations don't self-identify with that group. They can't. They're not of the group. So the folklore to them is meaningless. It's alien. They're not going to integrate to it either, because it's not part of their story. Furthermore, they won't want to, because they're bringing their own story, their own folklore with them. So when you have these communities that vanish from places like London or Sparkhill because they've been displaced, there's a little bit of a thread there that's severed. And when these communities disperse, they'll take that folklore with them, and it will kind of survive for a while. But even if you brought them back to the original location, it might be quite hard to reinstate that as it was, and the time it takes to reinstate that gets much, much larger as the time that community has been dispersed goes on. So if a community has been dispersed for, say, a generation or more, will the grandchildren of the people who originally lived in those areas come back and self-identify with that folklore in the same way? Will the great-grandchildren? That's a very good question. I don't think the answer to that is yes.
It's interesting, isn't it? It's like the life, it has to be constant, because it's like if an arm is severed, you can't just sew it back on. And indeed, the longer it remains severed, the more difficult it will be to reattach it and make it work again. I think it's quite similar.
And we have these things recorded. We may have pictures, we may have videos, we may have documentation. But those are just words on a piece of paper at the end of the day. What matters is that someone cares about them. Someone holds them in their living memory and in their heart. And when that fades, the words on the paper don't matter anymore. There's all sorts of stories I come across that are documented to these areas, but people have just stopped caring about them. And so because people stop caring about them, it makes them very difficult to bring back to life and tell to people, because they just go, oh, I didn't hear that growing up. I don't really care about it.
Yeah. Yeah. This is exactly what I was saying earlier. That when you discover that the town used to be different, it's like, oh, wow. And most people won't care. But unless you're rather eccentric like us, and we take the effort to understand how the past was, then it's sort of fascinating. But for most people, it will just be alien. It's like, well, that was the town then, but that's got nothing to do with me.
Yeah, but they'll understand that when they get older, though. When you get older and you start to see buildings that you identify with your childhood start to vanish, things that you were told growing up start to no longer be important to people, that's when I think it really hits home. And maybe that will be in your 30s and 40s. Sometimes that will be in your 60s. It depends on the rate of change of your hometown, doesn't it, really?
Indeed. I was rather shocked when, just on that note, I contacted some... my primary school where I used to go, and it was about a particular building that I loved there, and I wanted to ask them about it. It was demolished 20 years ago, and I communicated with the head teacher, and he didn't even know that there'd ever been a building there.
Oh my God.
Yeah, he had no idea what I was talking about.
It really hits home the impermanence of these things, doesn't it?
It's amazing. The building was there for 80 years, but now, 20 years later, it's as if it never existed. Go on.
Also, and again, that goes back to like the crooked house that we were talking about. It's been burned down now, and it's been gone for, I think, a year and a half. And at the moment, feeling is still very high. There's a whole community of people that are pushing very, very hard to get it restored brick by brick. And I think a court has actually ordered that, but they're appealing against it. And drawing it out is actually a very effective tactic for them, because the longer this goes on, the harder it is for people to care, and the less likely it is that it will get rebuilt.
Yeah, and then they'll accept like some awful little store just being put up in its place.
It's in a location that's very difficult for anything else useful to be there. I think the owners just want to turn it into landfill, basically, unfortunately, which is perhaps even worse.
Perhaps. Oh, that's terrible. I mean, and as you say, it's devious of them to stretch this out in the courts, because they well know that the longer they stretch it out, the less likely, the more people will just lose interest, because, well, it's been 2 years, it's been 5 years, it's been 8 years. I can't even quite remember how it looked now. And there are new people who never saw it, or who can barely remember it at all. It's sick. They're really sick. This is the kind of thing that I would just, you know, if I have these fantasies of being emperor, where I would just make it impossible to do this kind of thing. You know, it would be like a social death to do something like this.
Yeah, I think everyone agrees that these things need to be protected, because, you know, without these things, we lose our place in history, we lose our sense of ourselves, and we're diminished. When you're a town that doesn't have a museum, when you don't have your own artifacts, when you don't have your own stories, who are you anymore? You're just an economic zone.
Exactly. Of course, and that does seem to be what the powers that be would like us to be, just economic units that are completely interchangeable. And it is the history that prevents you from being just an interchangeable unit. It's your history, because that feeds into and makes up a huge part of your identity, which in turn differentiates you from everyone else in the world. So, yeah. With that said, defining what folklore is, would you like to say any more about how we should think of it, like practical, useful ways to think of it, or do you think that's been covered?
I think one of the most useful ways to think about it is just the way that groups of people identify the world around them. So it's not, if I can tell you what it's not very specifically, it's not just ghost stories. It's not just tales about monsters, and it's not just tales about murders. Folklore is encompassing everything that a group of people would have needed to know to navigate the world. It's their history, it's where they came from, it's what's happened in their town, and it's understanding events on a local, national, and as far as they could conceive of them, global scale, I think.
Right, yes. Okay, a sort of entire worldview informed by the history of a local area.
Yeah, if it kind of like almost like a religion, but more based on the experience of what was happening in the immediate day-to-day life, as opposed to dealing with moral systems in the afterlife.
Yes, yes. Okay, very interesting. Very interesting indeed. So, okay, you wanted to talk about how folklore began to be collected, because obviously this would have had a starting point, because why don't you take this away?
Well, I'd argue, going back to what I just said, as it's more than just ghost stories, that it's history as well, and that what we think of as history today would have been folklore to these people. So I'd argue that things like the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle are some of the earliest examples of folklore. If I want to go past the 18th century, looking back at what people thought and believed and what happened in certain areas, I'm not looking for books on folklore. I'm looking for books on natural history. I'm looking for books on antiquities, things that were recorded as being true at the time, or that academics noted many people thought was true. A good example of that is Robert Plott's Natural History of Staffordshire, where he records the story of Blake Mear up on the moorlands near Stoke-on-Trent. And he talks about it being this bottomless lake, this great black pit that goes on forever and might be sort of connected to the underworld. And he sort of dismisses it very offhandedly as like, well, my horse drinks from it, fine, I'll put my foot in it, and it doesn't go on forever, so clearly it's not all these things. But to the people of the time, though, these things rang true for them. And even though that story isn't quite as understood today, about the lake being connected to the sacred and it perhaps being bottomless, today it's been replaced with stories of a mermaid that lives there, an inland mermaid who's trapped. And if you go there as a single man and you perhaps aren't very respectful, she might not treat you very well. that's what I'd say about folklore being collected. It started off as history. It moved through. When you get to sort of the 18th century, you started to get people to be more interested in recording it as a separate thing to history. I think that came partially from empire. We started to be interested in what the stories of people overseas were saying. And then academics turned around and went, well, hold on. We've got some of this at home. Can we have a look at what that is? I've actually got a quote here from a folklorist called C.S. Byrne, who was around that time period. And she says that folklore has established itself as a generic term under which the traditional beliefs, customs, stories, songs, and sayings current among backwards peoples or retained by the uncultured classes of more advanced peoples are comprehended and included, comprising barbaric beliefs about the world of nature. It is the expression of the psychology of early man. Which I just find her brutal take on that to be very interesting, that she, an English lady, part of the intelligentsia, was talking about her fellow Englishmen of the working class in that way at that time, that even though she was recording them and she wanted to know their stories, she did herself regard them as very backwards and barbaric. And it kind of shows how there was a massive class divide at the time.
Yeah. Yeah, and there are interesting parallels with that today, of course.
Yes, let's have a look at what the little people think. I think we're all very familiar with that.
Yeah, indeed, especially in recent months. Okay, so then we get to the folk revival of the 70s. Perhaps there's more to say in the interim before that.
No, I think folklore did a very good job of being recorded very early on into the 18th and 19th century, and we did get a lot, but the amount of works being published did start to fall off until, you know, we lead up to World War II. And then, obviously, that was on nobody's mind for a while. But come the 50s, suddenly there's this huge revival in folk song and folklore. It kind of comes out of nowhere, but I do have a few ideas about what might have spurned it. I think personally it came out of a wanting to free from the malaise. The post-World War II era was a bit atheistic and was looking for meaning in the new world. And so they started to reach back for authenticity as economies started to improve again. You started to get a left wing that was revolting against capitalism. And what's more free and of the people than folklore and folk song? So the folk revival of the 70s was very much a left-wing thing to start with. People got together and they'd do little folk song competitions on a Friday, Saturday night. You let people in for a couple of pounds and you'd get a full night of sitting around drinking beer out of that. It kind of started in 1950 or so with like Ewan McColl and a few other popular singers who came up. And then they got on the radio and people would listen to them. People would learn their songs and they'd go along and sing them at the folk club. And it came a little bit of a game to them to learn new songs and show them off. And then if you were really good, you'd go along and write a few of your own. So we do have songs that were written in the folk revival period as well.
Right. And would you say that that was authentic? Does it sufficiently merge into the tradition that it doesn't seem like a graft?
Everyone takes a different approach. That's the interesting thing. So there were some people who took a very traditional approach. And by the way, for those who are unaware, a very traditional English approach to folk song is entirely lyrical. No accompanying instruments whatsoever. Just one person singing the song by themselves. You do also have, people might be more familiar with working songs and sea shanties that would have calls and refrains where multiple people would get involved with it. But even then, there were no instruments involved. When the folk revival came around, some people really wanted to stay true to that, and some people felt this doesn't sell. Ironic for a movement that started to be somewhat anti-capitalistic, but there you get it. Money tends to rule the day in these things eventually. You know, if one person's selling albums and another's not, you know, the adoration of the people at your folk club doesn't stack up that long, I guess. People want to make money, don't they?
Yeah, of course. So this was something that was popular in part of the popular culture, would you say, in the 50s and 60s and 70s?
Oh, increasingly. Like, it was a very normal thing to go down and enjoy this. And it split off in several directions. So one direction is, I think, Steel Ice Span, people might be familiar with, who took sort of folk songs and they add instruments and they very much modernize them to an extreme, to the extent they're almost unrecognizable. And other people, they took a different route and they tried to preserve and learn folk songs and go back and find some that were documented in libraries that hadn't even been sung in years. We're very good for that. I can't speak to other counties, but I can speak to my own. We had a folk singer called John Raven, which is partially where I get the idea for my own name, by the way. John Raven, who was originally a folk singer and folklorist, he started the Wolverhampton Folk Song Club around 1963. He was originally a teacher and just started to get interested in all these things. But he and his brother Michael, they went to the Birmingham Library and they started going through all these old books and looking through old newspapers. And they'd find these what are called broadside ballads. Now, a broadside ballad was a piece of paper that was sold very cheap, a bit like a penny dreadful. And it would have a little song on it and it would have the tune and you could take it home and learn it. And these songs, a lot of them didn't really persist in the folk tradition that made it through to the folk revival, but they were able to be brought back because everything was there. And even if you just had the lyrics, you could probably find a tune from another song that fit. And there's a good chance that that's what would have actually been sung to at the time. A good example of this, weirdly, is there's a song called Pirate Serenade that was found in Birmingham. Of all places, you'd think Birmingham being in the middle of the country, what's a song called Pirate Serenade doing there? But
yeah, that's not where you would expect it. On that thing about newspapers, it's amazing how, because I've been doing quite a lot of research of my own, and it's amazing how you can find things that were only recorded in like one article. Or if this article hadn't mentioned it, nobody would know about it now, like 100 years later, 150 years later. And it's quite amazing, actually, that the historical thread can be that thin, you know? It can be that tenuous that something gets preserved at all.
Yeah, some of these things were really on their last legs, particularly with folk singers. So a big thing that happened in the folk revival was a last push to document folk singers. People went out and found the Copper family. They found Harry Cox. If anyone has not listened to Harry Cox, I highly recommend tomorrow you go out and look him up on YouTube or Spotify. He was a farming man, and not from Staffordshire. And it gives you the real impression of sitting down and listening to your grandfather singing folk songs. Because these people were very old, and when the folk revival was going along, they looked for these people. It would be someone else in the town that recommended them. They'd say, oh, Harry comes down and sings on a Friday night, come and record him. And people found a wealth of songs that were otherwise unrecorded from just these old folk singers who didn't think anyone cared any longer. In Staffordshire, we have a couple as well. We have Cecilia Costello from Birmingham, but she was actually the child of Irish immigrants, so she's not a very good example of Birmingham folk song. We have George Dunn from the Black Country. He had quite a few, and Albert Shaw as well. Now, Albert Shaw is a really interesting one that I'd like to talk about, if that's okay. Albert Shaw has a whole wealth of several hundred folk songs, some of which are otherwise unrecorded, some of which are very well documented, but they're not digitized anywhere. And in fact, I almost didn't know who Albert Shaw was until I was going through a whole host of old folk albums from the 70s, and I saw another folk singer talk about how he learned a song from him. And I was like, I don't know this name, I'm going to investigate it. I managed to track down the family of Albert Shaw, who now live in Australia. And the granddaughter of Albert Shaw, she's very proud of her father. She's got all these old recordings, but likewise, she didn't think anyone really cared about them. I got her to send them over and have digitized them. And I do intend to put them up as soon as I'm able to, but it's so many that going through and properly cataloging them with the correct song titles is a humongous amount of work. But you have to think, this hadn't been sent off to a museum. This hadn't been sent off anywhere. And if his granddaughter had died, where would these CDs, the last recordings of this man's folk singing, have gone?
That's incredible. So is that going to be online? Are these recordings going to be made available? How are they being preserved?
Well, I'll preserve them on... Firstly, I'll put them on my YouTube channel, Staffordshire Folk Song, which is a side channel to the main channel. But I'll also do what I can to put them up elsewhere as well. And I will make sure that they're sent into museums as well, if they'll accept them. Sometimes museums are very happy to hear what you've got. Sometimes they're not.
Yeah. Well, I can only commend you. That's fantastic that you've done that.
A good example of museums not being interested, actually, is there's an old recording from Stoke-on-Trent of some prisoner of war soldiers. And they're all singing these folk songs. And in the British Library, they were recorded as the Unknown Soldiers. That didn't sit right with me. So I looked into it and found out that the recording had passed into the hands of folklorist Roy Palmer. And he'd actually written a book on them, and he'd named all of the soldiers individually. And from that, I was able to go and find their photos. I sent all this off to the British Library, and they kind of went, oh, thanks. Heard nothing back, and they still have not updated the catalogue to reflect that information. And you just have to wonder why.
Yeah, definitely. Again, it's great that you did that, that you took the time and put in the effort to do that. And it's disgraceful that they haven't acted on it. I don't know. I don't know what to say.
Well, I think they've got different priorities, haven't they?
Yeah, clearly. But you know, this is Britain. I mean, this should matter, and the British Museum should absolutely care about this stuff.
It shouldn't be random people on the internet doing it, for certain.
Yeah.
But if some of us don't take the time to do this, then no one will.
Yeah. I agree. Certainly.
Sorry.
So action there.
if you want me to go back to the significance of things a little bit,
well, this is very important. What you're saying here, I mean, this is very, very important stuff. But yeah, if you want to go back to the 70s and the revival, certainly.
Oh, well, so as well as folks on clubs, you also got heritage societies that started. The Black Country Society started in 1967, around the same time, because all these people did want to push these things forward, and there was a big momentum behind things, moving things forward at that time, that lasted well into the 90s until things started to fall apart. Which can kind of take you on to a whole cultural shift towards globalism and away from community, and which has led to a whole host of issues in terms of how we understand ourselves and our identity. I think one of the early things that would have caused that is radio, if you can understand that.
Well, I think it's important to say first that in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, people were still a lot more settled than they are today. So it's understandable that, I mean, they still lived in the ancestral towns. Not as many people went to university and got their heads filled with rubbish.
I entirely agree.
And so it's understandable that there was a revival then, which petered out in the 90s. It's understandable.
You've hit the nail on the head with another point there about the importance of universities in that. Universities changed everything. Previously, people worked a trade for their family in the hometown they came from. In the Black Country, you're probably a chainmaker. In Stoke-on-Trent, you probably made pottery. And in Burton, you probably made beer. Universities and the push to get people into higher education really changed that, because for the first time, you probably go into a university that's not in your hometown. You're being sent away to some other part of the country to learn. You're going to be there for several years. And then when you come home, you're going to be looking for a job that's not necessarily part of the family trade. You've got more incentive to move to a different area. So yes, university, I think, really was a critical factor in dissolution of communities.
Yeah. And then on top of that, you've obviously got the media, the first national, the BBC and so on, but then international as well. The internet and so on.
Yeah, if you can cast your mind back to a time, or if you can imagine a time 100 years ago, people didn't have radios, people didn't have televisions. Everything you heard probably came from people within your own town. You were taught inside your own town. You would have had newspapers. You might have had shows come to your town that you could have enjoyed. And so culture would have proliferated at a very, very slow rate. Suddenly, with radios and with household TVs later on, culture's broadcast from a central point somewhere, Birmingham or London, and it's sent out all over the nation at the same time to all these different communities and villages that were once isolated. Previously, communities self-identified to a very granular level. You had the Black Country identify themselves as themselves, and you had each town in the Black Country with their own identity. But more so than that, you had each street with their own identity, to the point that anecdotally in the Black Country, people used to get in fights with people from other streets. And if you married someone from a few streets away, they'd say, "Oh, look, he's gone off and married a foreigner."
Amazing. Again, this is another thing that I've noticed in my own research about my hometown, that each part, like the town 100 years ago, was divided into all these different little parts that today nobody would, like, there were these names for different bits of the town and that I didn't recognize. And, but eventually I identified each one and it's that bit. It's that corner. It's where the high street curves a bit. That used to have its own name. That was its own area. And it's quite astonishing, really, because obviously this is all just merged in the same way that everything else at a higher level has merged, like the countries, the accents, the counties. Even the different parts of a town used to be distinct.
And it's something that people have stopped fighting for a little bit, very sadly, is identity to that level. These days, we're talking about, can English culture be saved? Can European culture be saved? No one's even talking anymore about, can Walsall maintain its own singular identity? No one's saying, can Stoke-on-Trent maintain its own identity? All these accents are going to merge, as you've said. All these stories are going to be lost, and it's been replaced with a much wider culture. So going back again, you've got the households having radios and TVs, and I think in 1963, Doctor Who aired, which I know you've just done a whole series of Substack articles on. That was the first time, not Doctor Who in particular, but that era when stories and entertainment were broadcast nationally out of nowhere. And so suddenly you've got this whole new lore, not folklore, but still lore, that's being pumped into people's heads. And it kind of overrides the folklore that people know. Because you've in the same way you can only know X many names, I think there's a certain number, is it 110 names that you're able to remember?
Dunbar's number, I'll just look it up to make absolutely sure. It's 150, apparently.
Yeah, 150 names that you're able to remember. You can't remember all the lore in the world. So every fact that you remember about the Doctor's fourth regeneration, every fact you remember about what happened to the Grey Wardens in Dragon Age, it replaces something that you could know about your town or your city. And it's very sad, and I think it's very intentional. It's no accident that the acceleration towards the dissolution of community and understanding ourselves and our identities happened with mass media and broadcasting. And it's gotten worse, because previously you would have had regional TV. These folk songs that I'm talking about that would have been broadcast in the 50s and 60s, they were done regionally. A big one in the Midlands was Jake Thackeray, people like to listen to. But that wasn't necessarily the case everywhere. Now, all TV is national at the very least. You might have a news show that's centred on your local area, but everything else, everyone's watching at the same time. People in Scotland, people in Cornwall, people in London, they're all saying, what happened on Game of Thrones? What happened on Doctor Who's Christmas special this year? They're all talking about the same thing, and that's not normal historically. The only time that people would be obsessed with the same things were when there was major events happening, dissolution of the monasteries, or wars going on. But other times, everyone would be obsessed with what was going on in their local area.
Yeah, yeah. And again, you can see this from newspaper coverage of my hometown, that the life of the town mattered a great deal to the people. Another one, I was researching about a public park, a Victorian public park in Leeds. And the late 1900s, the authorities decided to close it at night for reasons that are obvious nowadays, but which were rather surprising to the Edwardians. And thousands of people protested. Thousands. I mean, that obviously that's a city, but it was a particular part of the city called Beeston. And I can't imagine that nowadays, but thousands, I think it was 5,000 people attended a protest about that. I mean, that would never happen now.
No,
I don't think.
And when you think about that, you've got to think about the number of people in the country or in the town as well. The percentage of the town that would have been astronomical. There would have been a real sense of social pressure to get involved with that, because everyone was. I mean, it must have been the majority of the town. We had a similar thing, actually, with William Palmer, a famous poisoner from Staffordshire in Rugeley. He was thought to have killed 3 of his children, along with his wife, and maybe his friend as well. And when he was caught, there was so much outrage about it that they had to break... they had to change the rules about trials. Previously, you would have had to have been tried where you lived. They had to move him down to London because there was so much outrage. There was no chance of him getting a fair trial. He was found guilty, and then he was moved back to Rugeley and hung at Stafford. The amount of people that came to that was, I think, it was thousands and thousands of people. It was so much that the crowd was said to stretch on as far as the eye could see. So the people on the outer bounds couldn't really get a good look at what was going on. Such things aren't really something you're able to think about happening today. Even when you see the gigantic protests in London for what's happening with the farmers, it doesn't quite give that impression, does it?
No, certainly not. That's fascinating. I think that you see this dissolution, and it's been something that we've lamented. But I think we are so tied to our time that we don't realize how bad it is, actually, because the historical comparisons, you know, as I say, 100 years ago, 200 years ago, we have already lost so much. And I don't want to be pessimistic or defeatist about this. I'm just making the point that we really have, like, modernity. I mean, you can blame capitalism. That's obviously part of it. But just modernity in general has had this effect. And even if you do get rid of capitalism or whatever, if you had some 15-minute cities or something like that, there is still this problem of technology. And that's a whole thing in itself, really, isn't it? Because technology can be used for good or ill. It's obviously helped, it's enabled you to contact and these people and preserve these records and preserve the recordings. But it's also the thing that distanced everyone from these things in the first place.
And we're not about to undo it. We can talk about how university may have played a part in it. And we could say in the future, maybe not everyone's going to go to university. It certainly looks like that's the way things are going. But radio, TV, smartphones, these things are not just about to plop out of our lives. You can't uninvent them. So there is going to be a real challenge of how do communities form, maintain, and keep themselves as a siloed structure in a world with this level of interconnectedness. It's probably going to take either massive social reform the way we think about things, or it's going to be something we need to adapt to in other ways, because I don't think that if we remain unsiloed and connected as we are, that we're not just going to become this big mass where we all have one accent, where we all think broadly the same thing about things, and we lose our soul, we lose our individuality.
Oh, absolutely. The overall effect of that is that we end up with a population that's basically indistinguishable from another population 1,000 miles away or 2,000 miles away or even across the Atlantic Ocean.
And
it used to be that they were distinctive just 5 miles away.
And that's exactly what they're doing with our cities. Other people have noted this before, but if you go into London, Birmingham or Paris, you see the same shops. You get the same feeling from the buildings. There's a very globalized architectural style to match this globalized people. And it all blends together. The lack of understanding of one's own folklore and the imposition of meta-narratives like Doctor Who, Star Wars, certain video games, these things that clog up your head. It's very cleverly designed to rob you of any sense of self that you've got.
That's the thing. That's the end result, is that we're just going to be bumbling around consuming product that doesn't even mean anything to us. I don't know. As you say, it is a very difficult nut to crack, because technology isn't going to go away. And so you have to try find a way to marry these two things. The mass availability of an astonishing range of media with people choosing something that is local to them and meaningful to them, and meaningful to them because it's local to them, and vice versa, and so forth, sort of feedback loop.
The difficulty is that folklore and folk song is very easy to enjoy in a community. You can get together and tell stories, you can get together and tell songs, and you can try and block the outside world out a little bit. But more and more people don't tend to live with people who think like them. Certainly in my town, there's not very many people that would enjoy listening to me sing folk songs. The people that do tend to live 20, 30 miles away, and I'm able to meet up with them a few times a year. That's going to be a big difficulty. Either we need to find people who think the same way and have them move closer together, or we're going to have to find some other way to bring people on board into enjoying things that not necessarily harken back to our heritage. I'm not asking everyone to become a historian, but things that just aren't part of the global mass, the consumerist culture.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to talking about the state of modern museums and local heritage societies. Is there, I mean, you've already touched on that. Would you say that that has, is an area that has been co-opted by the globalist regime and is now just used for its purposes, or are there pockets of rebellion against that?
There's a lot of problems, I think, with museums and heritage societies, and a lot of them stem from finances and their position in the world. So there's a few different examples. A good one that's most recent is the Cannock Chase Museum. It's this tiny little museum. It's in an old mining training center on the edge of Cannock Chase, but it's beautifully looked after. Everything in there is immaculate. There's these detailed boards, old artifacts, and the collection they've got behind the scenes is very, very large and currently undigitized. But the council is going to close it next year. They say they're going through a consultation period at the moment that ends on January 5th, but it's pretty clear from the way they're wording the consultation and from the fact the staff working there have already received their redundancy warning that this is going ahead and the museum's going to close. Why is that happening? Well, partially because they don't care. The council have no legal obligation to keep that museum open and provide those services. Partially because inflation's 40% over the last 10 years and their budget's only risen 15%, so they can't really afford to keep it open. Of course, closing the museum only makes a very short amount of that shortfall up, but they're happy to throw it straight in the bin because it's not important to them. So finances are one very important thing with the state of modern museums. But then you've got other ones like the Black Country Museum. They're much larger and they're doing very well financially. They've had a big investment from the Lottery Heritage Fund that's enabled them to expand. But there's a few caveats to that, because previously the Black Country Museum focused very much on older history, the mining history of the area, the industrial history of the area, moving up kind of into World War II and the 1940s sort of era. Part of the lottery heritage funding is they've pushed the timescale that they share information about forward from the 40s to the 60s, which is, amongst other things, it's one of the times that immigration started to really take hold in the 1960s in the Black Country. So it's enabled them to bring in all these new characters. They have these walking characters that walk around them, pretend to be figures of the past. I think one of them is literally called Mr. Patel or something now. Now, that's obviously been pushed by the Heritage Lottery Foundation, but it's also a result of the demographics of the area changing. The Black Country Museum is sat in the heart of rapidly changing demographics, and year on year, the people that come to the museum, less and less of them are the English people that have historically inhabited the Black Country area, and more of them are these new communities that have come in. And the new communities come in and look around and go, well, why should I care? And in fact, if you look at their feedback form, one of the questions they ask you is, did you feel represented? Did you feel that the things here were important to you and your story? Clearly, because these people have mentioned in the past, no, I don't feel represented and I don't feel the story of our people's arrival here is brought up enough.
So that's a question. It's a leading question, because there's only one way they can answer it, which is no. Obviously, I'm not represented here, because they weren't part of that history. You can fake it, like it's sometimes done, and you can pretend that there were people like them in Birmingham, in Edinburgh in the 5th century or something, but everyone knows that it's not true.
They always use the exception to prove the rule, don't they? They find one person who came over here in, say, the late 1700s, early 1800s, and they say, there you go, they were always there, when it was in reality literally one person who is historically documented specifically because they were that one person, and it was such a novelty at the time. But yeah, no, so yeah. The museum has to really find its identity. Where's it going to go and what's it going to do? Because The people who have been there want it to remain what it is, about their own heritage. The people who are coming in don't feel it represents them and want it to be something else. And ultimately, who's going to win? Well, whoever lives there, whoever's going to see it, whoever's providing the financial resources to maintain it. Now, what happens to all the stories and all the artifacts and all the displays of the people who represent that older community as it changes? who knows? We'll have to see, won't we? Unless things are prevented from going in that direction, unless things turn around.
This is a thing. I mean, it's as you said at the start, that our folklore is not their folklore, and therefore our folklore can only strike them as alien. And therefore you can only make it relevant and relatable to them by changing it out of recognition and falsifying the history and involving their culture, their history, their heritage in it, grafting that into it some way, which really, this is a thing where there is no good way to handle this. It's a situation that can only be bad.
Yeah. They can have a passing interest in these things, but yeah, they're never going to appreciate it the same way as the people who are the descendants, the people who remember their grandfather wearing the mining uniform, or the ones who know their great-great-grandfather once beat those chains into position and on a near-starvation diet, because they weren't paid very much. They can know that the anchor of the Titanic was forged in Netherton and go, well, why do I care? What's that got to do with me? Absolutely nothing. So that's a few things that's going on with museums. Lack of funding in a world where inflation's out of control is part of it, demographic change. And the same thing's happening to local heritage societies as well, I think. But not so much demographic change as an issue with age groups. So local heritage societies have historically... older people tend to be more interested in them. As you see your town change, as you see the buildings disappear, maybe you feel a stronger pull to look up your family history or look at the old buildings that were there before your time. I think that's a fairly normal thing to do. So history societies have always had an older age appeal, but that's really shifting now. And if you look at who goes along to these meetings, who takes part in these committees, it tends to be people who are 60 plus. There's no young blood coming in, and so that can be positive in one way, in that they have short-term financial security, because as grim as it sounds, as some of these elderly members of these societies die off, they do bequeath money to these societies that's going to keep them going in the short run. But then they're not getting young blood in to actually come in and do anything with the society and take it forward and bring new lessons and lectures and new activities and try and revitalize the society, because they're not offering anything that's appealing to young people. They don't know how to do it. They want to talk about history, and young people aren't interested in it because the young people don't feel that sense of identity, I think.
Yeah, that is obviously a very real problem. And it stems from what we were saying earlier, that young people are immersed in global media, national media. A big thing is that TV series nowadays have international funding. So even something that is made by the BBC, for example, it has American funding or Australian funding or something or whatever. So that is what people are immersed in now. That's what young people think of as their culture. So the opposite, the folklore that you're talking about is the opposite extreme of that.
It's very difficult to make it appealing. It's very difficult to talk about, this mining accident that happened 200 years ago, as opposed to what happened on Game of Thrones last night. One is very action-packed, it's very fast-paced, and it's got a lot of dramatic appeal. The other one, unless you're a family member, unless this has some sort of personal connection, most people will struggle to connect to it, most people will struggle to enjoy it. And most people, it's difficult to make entertainment out of that kind of history as well. I'm sure the BBC could, if they put their mind and their budget to it. I'm sure there's a lot of fantastic stories from the British Isles that could be told, and I'm sure people could enjoy that, but there's no interest in that, is there?
Indeed. So that obviously is one of the dangers facing folklore, but you wanted to talk about others, other dangers facing folklore just now, and you you listed quite a few. AI, folk horror, paranormal grifters, Amazon repackers, etc. Well, let's go through each of those.
Oh, where to start? Sure, maybe AI is a good one to start with. We talked about it before, you touched on it, about how they might fake history in order to make people feel included. I do wonder if that is going to be one of the main uses for AI going forward. At the moment, what one thing that does seem to get people's attention is old photographs and videos. You see it all the time, photographs of working class children barefoot in the street saying, these children weren't privileged. Or you see videos, very old videos of people walking through the streets in working class parts of England, and people feel an instant connection with those, even if they're not entertainment. They do hold a lot of power for people, and obviously, what's missing from those is other communities that they would like to be included. That they would, I'm sure, they would love if they were in those videos, but they're not because they weren't here at the time. Ultimately, what are they going to do? I think they're going to start faking them with AI. This is something I see on Facebook and Twitter fairly regularly now, is you'll see videos of giants building the pyramids of Egypt, and for some reason, there are some people who take that seriously. Even though it's very clearly an AI-generated video, there are people who, oh my god, this is absolutely true. And maybe when it's video, enough people can see this is ridiculous, this is obviously not true. But when you start doing photographs, there's one recently, that little boy from the Blitz. There's a little black child from the Blitz that's the point of a new BBC documentary. I'm sure that is real. I'm sure that is real. But if they started AI generating photographs like that and just telling us they were real, how would we know that they weren't? If museums took them on board and said, yep, we stamp our seal of approval, this is a real photograph, how could you possibly say, as an ordinary person, no, you're talking nonsense?
Well, also, they wouldn't need to certify each photo. They could just say, we believe that these are representative of, yes, they're AI images, they've been artificially created, but we believe that they're representative of the way things actually were then. So They're a guide to how it was, and that would be convincing enough for most people. Most people would just accept that.
Yeah, and they don't even need to use them as specific examples. They can use them, like you say, as illustration. There was an article today about in first cousin marriages, and they used some white people in the picture, I think. That's the sort of thing they'll do. They'll talk about various different communities over time, and they'll just use these AI-generated images that aren't real, and it'll give false impressions. You can lead a lot of people to a conclusion with just a false impression, even without outright lying.
Yes, definitely. That's a big thing, and the media are experts at doing this, at misleading without outright lying. I mean, they've been doing it for decades. They're experts. So it's a really sick thing. It's often the suggestion rather than the outright, the explicit statement that creates the lasting impression and thereby shapes the worldview.
Yeah. Other dangers that go on, you mentioned folk horror. Now, this goes back to what I was talking about with it not being entertaining and TV shows being a preferable alternative media for most people. So I think a lot of people who do get interested in folklore and want to share it, and if they hope to get any sort of attention, they come to realize this, is that folklore doesn't sell very well. A previous folklorist I mentioned, John Raven, he used to get very upset because he'd go on things like Black Country Night Out and try and tell folk stories, and people wouldn't respond to it. He'd come off not very happy, apparently. And it's something I've found as well, that people aren't too interested in the old stories. So you try and find ways to jazz them up a little bit. I do that with my animations. I try and make things that are obviously patently ridiculous or jokes to make it clear that I'm not polluting the actual folklore. Because to me, it's very important that those things stay unmolested. It's very important that people have a true idea of what's real and what was really believed, and that that's not confused with entertainment. Other people don't have those scruples. What I'd like to do is I'd like to point out a video that exists. It's called British Cryptids, The Woodwows of Cannock Chase, and it's from a YouTube channel called British Cryptids 1974. Now, some of you may have seen this. It's got a lot of views. It's got almost 31,000 views, and it aired on January 1st, 2023. Now, 30,000 views is a lot of views. It's 10 times more views than my most popular video. And this video is very well made. It's very enjoyable entertainment to watch. The problem is, it's nonsense. It's not true. And it's presented as though it's factual. So much so that I continually have people ask me about the wood woes of Cannock Chase. In fact, before coming on the show tonight, someone said, are you going to talk about this? And I had to break the news to them. Yes, I am. And it's not going to be positive, which kind of feels like breaking the news about Father Christmas to a young child. But the way that this person fakes the story of the wood woes Cannock Chase is what's so egregious. Firstly, the entire video isn't presented as an informational YouTube video. It's framed as an archive film made in 1974 that was found and that they've restored. It's presented as a informational series made by either the BBC or by some education ministry in 1974. And there's a whole series of them on the YouTube channel. And they say, we found them and restored them. Look at how marvelous they are. They're even in 4:3 aspect ratio. The resolution isn't fantastic. Just enough to convince you, while still being watchable to the modern audience, that this is true. And what really sells it to people is that they use sources. Like I do, they'll reference a book, they'll show you the article, they'll show you the page. Now, I've got a few examples of this. The first one they use is called The Annals of Lichfield by Nicholas Firkin. That book does not exist. you can go on Google Books, you can go to the British Library, you can go on WorldCat, which is a catalogue of all sorts of libraries around the world. If a book exists, no matter how rare it is, it should appear somewhere. It doesn't. This book does not exist. The second book it uses is called Through England on a Side Saddle in the Time of William and Mary by Celia Finnes. This book does exist. It's actually one of the photos that I've sent you, Woz. If you put up saddle and saddle proof, the images that I sent you.
There we go. That's saddle and saddle proof. Yeah. Okay. So that's saddle.
So that's saddle there. This is what's in his YouTube video. And it references Cankwood is pleasant riding. It's a mezzanine. And this is what he uses to prove the wood woes. About halfway down the page, it mentions this is where abide the wood woes or wild men. So I just went and looked this book up, and it does exist, unlike the first one. And I went to page 81, which is the next book, the next photograph. And you can see Celia Finnes, page 81. This is the same book. It's total fabrication. None of the text matches at all. But looking at it, looking at the way he's written it, it's very convincing. Even the old-time spellings of things. You showed that to someone without context, would anyone think that was a fake image?
Yeah, that is incredible. The only thing I would say is maybe it's a different paging, a different edition.
I don't know. And if you go further on as well to the next one. So this is the one that appears in this video. Friday, October 30th, 1829. Miracle after dreadful accident in a coal pit. And particularly pay attention to the first line. A shocking occurrence took place on Friday morning last at a coal pit situated in the township of Rugeley. And then if you go to the next image, which is the actual article that does really exist. Same date. Dreadful accident in a coal pit. And the first line is the same. A shocking occurrence took place on Friday morning last at a coal pit belonging to Mr. Andrew Knowles of Little Bolton.
Oh dear.
They've gone to the trouble of finding real articles and editing them so that if you do cursory searches, you might be fooled.
And it's disgraceful.
It goes on as well. The next one is a book of poetry called Reflections on Cannock Chase by John Ralph, which just doesn't exist either. It doesn't exist. You can search everywhere. I can't find anything on the poet or the book. And I understand to people listening, they might say, Staffordshire Folklore just doesn't know what he's talking about. These are old books. They're hard to find. But one thing you do notice when you read enough about local folklore is that books reference each other. They like to reference back to where they got their sources. So modern books reference John Raven. John Raven will reference Pitman from Cannock Chase, or he'll mention Robert Plott's Natural History of Staffordshire. They'll all follow the continuity back. At some point, someone does get something wrong, something's missed, or something new is discovered. But you never get four sources, five sources that just are seemingly entirely fabricated or non-existent. I've spoke to other local historians and folklorists about this, and no one has ever heard of these books. But there are 30,000 people who've seen that video now that are entirely convinced and tell me, you don't know what you're talking about. He shows the sources in the video. Well, it's very, just, very hard to push back against that.
Yeah, and this is disgraceful because, as you've outlined, folklore is something that's already in danger because it's not given sufficient funding, attention, and so on. But then somebody steps in to pollute it with lies anyway, on top of that. I mean, that's shameful.
And I have to say, right, the video does deserve 30,000 views. It's a very well-made, entertaining video. If it didn't present itself as factual to the degree that it does, I'd be up there singing its praises. I'd enjoy it. But just the way that it does it, it now pollutes things. And 50 years from now, people are going to be convinced that this was always part of the story of Cannock Chase, when it's been entirely invented.
It's funny, isn't it? Because we hear about this kind of thing happening in the past when people were less careful and fastidious, and they didn't have the primary sources. But actually, it can also happen in the age of the internet when it's not that difficult to check things.
When I've called people out on this before, they've said to me, well, what does it matter? Folklore was all stories. It was all made up by somebody at some point. What's the difference between me making it up now and them making it up back then? Which I think is a really disgusting way to think, to be honest.
Yeah, I would agree. The whole point of this is preserving something, not adding to the confusion.
The worst thing is that Cannock Chase does have folklore, and it's just because people have ignored it for that long that it feels forgotten. People feel like there's nothing in Cannock Chase and there should be. Well, there is. It's just it's not quite as glamorous and it's a little bit older and you need to look further back. But there are stories of hermits who lived out their days on Cannock Chase. There are stories of highwaymen buried on Cannock Chase. There are stories of criminals who accidentally tripped on a branch and hung themselves while being chased by the law. There are fascinating tales to be told on Cannock Chase, but they require a little bit more work to look into and learn. And they don't sell quite as well as a mythical, hairy Bigfoot monster living on Cannock Chase. So they're not what people focus on.
No. It's very unfortunate. And then the next one you've got is paranormal grifters.
Oh, well.
Well, is that what we were just talking about, superstition?
No, you'll see that as well. There's a lot of people who'll take things. This is more ghost hunters, ghost hunting YouTube channels and things like that, which, again, I don't necessarily have too much of a problem with, other than when they brush up against folklore and they'll go to places like Castle Ring on Cannock Chase and they'll say, oh, there's the ghost of a girl here who's 1,000 years old and was chasing us through the woods. Can you see her? Can you hear her in the video? And it's again, entirely fabricated just to make themselves seem like they've got something more entertaining to sell other than them walking around the woods in the dark. But some of them get a bit disgusting with it as well, to be honest. And that's one in particular, the Black-Eyed Children of Cannock Chase. That one really does upset me because there's no historical parallel for that. Going back prior to 2010 or so, people weren't talking about this. This was never part of the folklore of Cannock Chase. But it does connect to a series of children murders that did happen on Cannock Chase several decades ago. And the family members of those little boys and girls that were murdered, they're still around today, and now they're hearing stories about small children on the chase. You might say, oh, that proves it's true then. Apart from people tend to say that the children were dressed in Victorian clothing as opposed to sort of 1970s clothing, which shows, I think, again, that it's not true. There's a video on YouTube of someone supposedly spotting this black-eyed child in the tree line. It's clearly just a woman in a dress waving. But still, some people believe that.
Well, I think people want to believe it. This is a thing that Nigel Neal said, that he was a writer of science fiction and horror, mostly TV, and he said that he, I can't remember the exact wording, but he said that he he sort of despises his audience for being stupid enough to want to believe in this stuff. And I thought, what the hell? That's a dreadful attitude to have. Because, yeah, I do want to believe in this stuff. At least I want to take it seriously while I'm watching it. I think it's a natural human impulse to be curious about the supernatural and so on. So, yeah, you can't blame people for being into it.
But no, no, I've been accused in the past of fact-checking folklore, and I can see how it comes across as that, but I don't want to tell people that anything is true or isn't true. I'm more interested in, does this authentically represent the worldview of the people of an area? If people want to say, is there a pigman on Cannock Chase? I don't particularly care. What I do care about is saying people have always believed there's been a pigman on Cannock Chase. This is something that people believed in the 1800s because it's nonsense. And now you're just vandalizing the identity and past of a people. It's not on.
Yeah, and there's enough of that going on already. God knows. And then the last one you said is Amazon repackers.
Oh, yeah, this one's more people just trying to make a big quick buck and being lazy, but it's very hard to collect folklore properly. The work I've done with folk song in contacting people's relatives, digitizing things that are on the brink of being lost, that takes me weeks, and it takes me being very nice to people, and there's a lot of times I get close to something and I get shut down because someone gets a bad feeling from me, or someone just loses interest, or people think, a lot of times people think I'm a scammer, that I'm trying to make profit off them. That's very sad. It takes a lot of work to do these things authentically. What's really easy is to grab an old book of folklore from 1974 or so, read the chapter headers, and then just like paraphrase everything that's written in there and sell it on Amazon, self-published as your own work, and make, I don't even know how much money these people are making, but I see the books everywhere in the libraries, so they must be selling to someone. I could do that, but I don't think that adds anything to the conversation, making a quick buck off just repackaging things cheap and easy as if it was fast food, and usually getting things wrong in the process because people misquote things or don't look into things, lies or mistakes from books that were written in the 70s and 80s get compounded with more mistakes when they're repeated in the modern day. There's a few people around Cannock Chase and Staffordshire who are particularly egregious at this, but I don't think it would be fair to name names.
Probably not, no. But yeah, it's enough to say that the phenomenon is a real one. It's very unfortunate. And then moving on, why there should be a new folk revival. So talk about that.
Well, it's using technology to our advantage. We can't get rid of it. So it's doing what we can to try and bring this to new audiences and reinvigorate things and try and spurn the interest in each other. So there's lots of things we can be doing. We can watch folklore, we can read folklore, we can share it, we can learn songs, and we should be documenting things. I think every generation seems to think it's the last gasp and the last chance. You know, they thought that in the 1800s when C.S. Byrne was writing her book. They thought that in the 60s and 70s when they were recording Harry Cox, they thought this is the last chance to get authentic tradition down. But that's never the case, because folklore, like history, is never finished. It may be distorted, it may be polluted, it may become harder to discern what's true from what's being forced to popular culture through entertainment, but there's always something there and there's something new to be recorded. Right now, the last wave of folklorists and folk singers from the 60s, 70s and 80s are getting very, very old. They have material that's sitting around waiting to be published, waiting to be shared. And if no one does anything, it might just vanish. There might be things that never made it into books, never made it onto CDs, never made it onto records, and we can save them if we make a concerted effort. We should be doing this. Like, we should be going out and trying to contact these people, record what all these old folk groups were, record their songs, because they spoke to how our people were at that time when things were changing so much. We can see it's part of our story. But more than that, we could do new folk songs in particular. Not many people are trying to do this. There's is she called Eat Bake Sing, Julie Russell? I think that's her name. She's very good. She's very good at trying to keep it alive and trying to put new songs out there. Walshensman as well. That's a little bit more sort of like dark folk. It's less traditional folk song, but it's still an authentic expression of people. And I think the taboo's been broken now. I think people don't tend to want to listen to just a singer singing a cappella. I think things are going to move increasingly towards instrumentation and higher production values. So anything that speaks to us and our identity as it is right now is important to record and to take forward culturally.
Oh, definitely. Certainly. So, I mean, I would hope that other people will be inspired by what you're saying and try to get on board with this and join in the effort to preserve the past and to preserve these things that can, with not much effort right now, be preserved, but also to add to the body of it with new stuff as well. I think that's a very good, worthy call.
And we can clarify things as well. Like those, I touched on them earlier, the soldiers from Stoke-on-Trent who are mislabeled by the British Library and British Museum. I've recorded that. I've put that on YouTube. I've tried to make that as public as I can. I've tried to correct the collection. There are undoubtedly other examples of that where we can prove things are mislabeled or there's more information there. It does take a lot of time, it does take effort, and maybe you'd rather be watching Netflix, but it's important work. And if you don't do it, then it could be lost.
Definitely. I mean, presumably you're familiar with archive.org.
Is that Internet Archive or?
Yes, the Internet Archive.
Oh, actually, yes, I am very familiar with it. You
reminded me of something. In a negative way or what?
No, you just reminded me, going back to the British Cryptids video again. One of the things was that a pamphlet that he shows in there called The Wood Woes of Cannock Chase has been uploaded to Internet Archive as a penny dreadful. And it's listed, the date on there is listed as 1867. Now, this could be an authentic penny dreadful that's on archive.org. I don't think so, because it's so heavily used in his video that he uses so many fraudulent sources, because the entire scan is just very, very clean. But most of all, because this account, with not many other posts, uploaded this at the exact same time as the video, and there is no other record of this penny dreadful anywhere that I can find. But because it's on archive.org with the date of 1867, which the uploader has just entered themselves manually, again, it's another source that people might take seriously.
Yeah. Well, that's a problem. But what I was going to say about archive.org is that I've been using it quite a lot recently, and in the last sort of year and a half. And something that I've been doing is whenever I need a document and it's not there, if I can find a copy of it on somewhere in the world, I've done this two or three times now, I'll get it, scan it, and add it to archive.org so that, you know, because that might be one of the last surviving copies or the last one that's available. So I've done that a few times, and it's something that gives me a great sense of, I'm going to say it, and it sounds self-righteous, but it does give me a great sense of satisfaction to know that that document is now preserved. It's now okay. It's safe for the future.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. I've done the same thing myself a few times with documents. It's the best thing that we've got access to as members of the public. As precarious as its position is, the only thing you have to be careful of sometimes is copyright, depending on what the document is.
Of course.
Because that's the last thing you want to get yourself into trouble over.
But. Yeah, of course. But it is something of it. If you have an old book in your house, and it might well be one of the last copies, I would urge people to check that and have a look. And if it's not there on archive.org, you might want to scan it. Obviously, copyright issues aside, you might want to do that so that it is preserved. But when it comes to local folklore, obviously this is even more important because there are even fewer copies of things. Again, I've got a copy of a book that was written in my hometown by a man, he was a chemist in my town in Linlithgow, and he wrote a book about the history of the town, just a small pamphlet, really, not so much a book. And I managed to find a copy of it, and I'm going to digitize that and add it to archive.org, because that's stuff that otherwise will certainly be forgotten.
That's wonderful work that you've done there then. Yeah, that's absolutely fantastic, and that's what I'd love to see more people getting involved with, because ultimately everyone's got a town, everyone's got their own little corner of the world, and it's impossible for one person to track all of these things down. It has to be a communal effort.
Oh, absolutely, and every little helps as well. I mean, you might not have much time. You might just be able to add one document, but that's great. That's one document that's now going to be preserved. So yeah, that's something I'll be doing after Millennial. So yeah, that's a very interesting thing. And I really do think that a lot of people could do this. I mean, it doesn't cost much money. Sometimes it costs no money at all. And, you know, there are a lot of people who I think could do this and should do it. You're Nicole.
You're kind of jumping ahead to something I wanted to talk about, but now seems like a good time to segue into it, which is how people can get involved if they want to do this kind of thing, where you go from if you've just got a passing interest to wanting to get fully involved and starting, I don't know, Shropshire folklore, you know, Glasgow folklore, who knows. So the best way to start is reading old books, and I'd recommend going back to the 1970s, there's a few good book series. One of them is the Batsford Book Collection. There's a whole host of them. There's Folklore of the Cotswolds, Cornwall, Devon, East Anglia. The list goes on and on. Not every county is represented, but there's a good selection there. If you can't find ones from this particular collection, just Google the Folklore of and then your county or the area you're interested in. There will be something. Try and find it not from 2000s onwards, but preferably before that. And you want something particularly that lists its sources and that has a bibliography. Go back, read through it, read the stories, find the ones that interest you, and just pick something. And then look where they found that story from. If they recorded it themselves, great. See if you can find anything more about where they recorded it. If it's from another book, go back and read that book. Once you start going 100 years or so ago, you start being able to find things for free on either archive.org or Google Books. Google Books will have a lot of old books that the copyright has expired on that you can go and read in their entirety and download for free. If not, if it's particularly if it's a local history book, you can go to your local library. They should all have local history sections and little archives, and they should have copies of any book that's important to the local area. You can ask to see them. Usually they won't charge you any money. You might have to get an archive card if it's an actual archive, but that just means giving them some ID. And then go through and read those old books and go through and look for sources, and then pick a tale. Pick a tale and research that one tale as much as you can. Try and find things that those folklorists haven't mentioned themselves. Before you know it, you'll be an expert in that one story. And then you can talk to anyone about that story and be on equal footing at the very least, if not the expert in the room. And do that for then another story, and then another story, and then another story. And before you know it, you'll be a proper county folklorist. You'll be able to talk about whole swathes of things. You can do the same thing for folk music. You can go get an old LP and listen it through. And then look at the record label. Who else did they do in the local area? Who does the artist credit with teaching them those songs? Does it go back to a traditional singer? Can you find that traditional singer everywhere? There are lots of tools that you can use for free, and lots of them are done online. You could do the vast majority of this project with a scanner, a vinyl record player, and a computer. It's not an expensive hobby to have, and you will never run out of avenues to explore. Even just for your county, there are far more stories, I promise you, than you can record in your lifetime. And it's something you absolutely should do.
Yeah, and it is rewarding. I can say this with hand in my heart. You know, I can say this from personal experience. It is something that's very stimulating and rewarding to be doing. It's happened in the course of doing my Substack, but just in and of itself, I think it's worth doing, and it's exciting. So the next thing you wanted to say was about the question of, can there be new folklore in this day and age? What would you say about that?
I think that the existence of folklore and the development of folklore is reliant upon the existence of a community that is siloed to some degree. So you need to exist as a group, you need to understand yourselves as a group, and you need to be somewhat disconnected from outside influences. One of the reasons that I don't consider a lot of the things that have happened in Cannock Chase area to be proper folklore is because they're not authentic expressions of people that live here. A lot of it is coming from American influences. The Black-Eyed Children thing on Cannock Chase, if you look it up, it directly follows a spate of these reported sightings happening in America. Once it became a sort of trendy online folk horror thing, people suddenly started seeing it here. Same thing with pigmen, werewolves, and now woodwows as well. Can new folklore exist? Yes, I think we do see new folklore existing because, like I said, these communities don't have to be region locked and they don't even need to be in person. I might be going out on a limb here, but I'd say that if you've ever been part of a Discord group or a medium-sized WhatsApp group, those things kind of have their own folklore. You kind of have your own stories to tell, things that have happened in jokes. You all probably have similar ways of looking at the world. So these things are developing all the time. Communities as well. Fandoms for various different, you know, entertainment properties. They develop their own weird kind of lore as a community. Not that it's necessarily the healthiest thing, or an accurate worldview. So there is this innate human urge to gravitate towards folklore. And I'd argue that a lot of internet personalities are kind of folklorists without realizing it. I'd say that the likes of Mr. Metica is a kind of modern folklorist. He's
yeah, I suppose so.
He's kind of archiving stories of happenings on the internet, isn't he? He goes through old Tumblr blogs and Discord links and these stories of things that people have been up to that are completely shocking and thought-provoking, and he records them. I mean, Count Dankula is doing the same thing with his Mad Lads series. I mean, if the story of Dragon Lord isn't folklore in some way, then it's very entertaining at the very least. But I think even they realize that to some degree, because Count Dankula made an attempt. I don't know if he's still doing it, but he did try to transition to doing the exact same format of show, not about Mad Lads, but about folklore. I'm not sure whether it was successful or not, but the fact that he did it instinctively shows you how close those things really are. So we're always trying to get back to a kind of folklore, a kind of thing that we understand. If you have a Telegram chat or a Discord group, you probably all have an agreement about what's happening in the world. The COVID vaccine is a good example. Certain groups of people are going to say, it's fantastic, get it in my arm, the anti-vax has almost killed us all. Other groups of people are going to say, well, it was profit-driven, and it's probably not great for us, but ultimately it's probably harmless. And then some groups of people are going to say, no, it was a Bill Gates conspiracy theory to put microchips in us. And all of those people, within their own head, that's true for them. That's their own understanding of the world. That's their own folklore and their own narrative, not evaluating which of those is true. But you certainly will agree more broadly with one of those three, maybe somewhere in the middle. And it's the same for any event, Syria, what's happening in Palestine right now, Keir Starmer and the World Economic Forum, and everything comes to these little narratives we build for ourselves. The difference is that we've lost the lens of looking at these locally, and now we're obsessed with things on the national and global scale. And so folklore is becoming decentralized. It's becoming something that is entirely online in our own little communities. that's not healthy, and the way we get out of that is by building communities that silo off from national and global events and focus on our local area. And then folklore, as we think of it, these stories that are more magical, that deal with the spiritual, that deal with things that relate directly to our environment, I think they'll return naturally.
All right, excellent. Well, I think that seems to be a good place to end. I mean, is there anything else that you'd like to say in wrapping up, and maybe specifically about how people can get involved?
No, so I think what I've said before is a good example of how to get involved. Get your computer, get a scanner, get a vinyl record player. You don't even need all three of those. A computer would do. Start reading old books. Start listening to old music, and then just dig in one direction until you hit gold. You'll find something. My final thoughts are that we don't need someone to do everything. There are some people out there who are fantastic at taking a sort of English folklore approach. If anyone's not watching Jolly Reaver, go watch him. He's fantastic. But he's one person, and he's not going to be able to document every story in the British Isles. I'm focusing on one county, but I will not collect everything from my county. It's an inhuman job. What we need is not someone to do everything. We need everyone to do a little bit. If everyone learns a story, if everyone learns a song, if everyone just preserves something of their local area, we'll be in a much better position going forward.
Yeah, definitely. There was one question that I wanted to ask. There are a few super chats as well, but there was one question I wanted to ask. Do you have any thoughts on the Abbott's Bromley horn dance?
Yes, that's a very interesting one. I always quite enjoy how the Abbott's Bromley horn dance kind of becomes emblematic of Staffordshire, because it's a very pleasant thing compared to the grimy nature of the Black Country. If you ever look at old folklore books, the antlers tend to be on the front cover. Some people think that those are elk antlers, but they're not. They're reindeer antlers, and they probably date from the 11th century. When interestingly, there were no reindeer in the country at the time, so a lot of people think they were brought over from Scandinavia. The point of the dance, I mean, it's so interesting, because it's one of those things that's so old that no one remembers anymore. It's a part of our history that's so ancient that we do it because we do it. A lot of people have theories. Some people think it's a fertility dance. Some people think it's a pagan ritual. Some people think that it's about celebrating hunting rights. It's evolved over the years. It incorporates elements of mumming plays with characters like Robin Hood and Maid Marian, and they dance around. If anyone's not seen it, you can probably find videos of the dance on YouTube, and it is quite pretty, and the tune, that the hornpipe tunes that they use, are one of the most folky things that I think you'll ever listen to. There's a very old superstition the antlers shouldn't ever leave the church apart from when they're doing the dance, but the horn dancers do get asked to go and perform the dance at various different places around the country. So they've had replica sets made. And it's a good job, because one time apparently they were in Burton-on-Trent performing. Now, Burton-on-Trent's very famous for its beer. And they went out after the dance and started drinking. And while crossing the bridge, one of them dropped the antlers straight into the river, into the Trent, lost forever. So it was a good job. That was a replica.
Oh, my God. Definitely.
Yeah, it's also, and this is something that never really gets talked about anywhere else, because I think maybe a lot of people don't understand this, but the horn dance has traditionally always been the responsibility of two families from the village who have always lived there. One's called Bentley and the other's called Fowl. And it could only be done by male members of the family. I think now they allow the girls of the family to do it as well. I don't think outsiders to those families are allowed to take part in the... You're allowed to watch the dance. You're allowed to go and attend, but you can't actually be a dancer, I don't think, unless you're one of those two families. So if you want to take part in it, the only way in is through, courting one of the young girls, I'd imagine, if you're a man, or buttering up one of the men if you're a girl, although that's a very recent thing. they originally would have taken care of those antlers as well, the two families, but the maintenance costs on them, like preserving them, restoring them, making sure that adequate security is there, became far too much for just like a couple of ordinary families to manage. So I think a deal has been struck where the council take care of the finances and technically own the antlers, but it's still the family that arranges and takes part in the dance. The antlers are kept in the church all year round, and if you go for a service, you can see them. If you want to go and attend the dance, please do. If you Google it and you look up their Facebook pages, you'll find the date. It does start very early in the morning. I think it starts usually at about 7 a.m. So you have to get up very, very early to attend it. And what they do is they do a little dance in the village square, and then they walk up and they perform the dance several hundred meters up. And they do that all the way around the country lanes, all around Abbots Bromley, until they get to Blithfield Hall. And that's where there's kind of a big fair. And that's the halfway point. And then they go back again, back to the church. So it's kind of blessing the entire land, I guess, if you see it as some sort of religious ritual. It's followed by big celebrations in the village later. The pubs are very, very full. Right. It's a spectacular thing to witness.
Yeah, I've heard about it. In several years, I've intended to go, but things have just come up. It's happened 3 years now, three times, where something came up that I couldn't do it. It's a shame, because I really do want to see that.
Touch wood, it's not going anywhere.
Yeah, I hope not. Okay, so then the super chats on Odyssey are from Swata. It says, Swala says, good work, Staffordshire Folklore. And Thin Red Line said, have you approached the EFDSS with it?
Oh, yes.
Sharp House. Alas, they have gone all PC, but it is still our folk music.
Yes, I absolutely have approached the English Folk Dance and Song Society. I don't like doing the acronym because I always say it wrong. They were very interested in the things that I was talking about. I negotiated with them adequate consent forms for people that I'm recording interviews of and for folk music that hopefully mean that they can accept it into their collection. Rather than drip feed, though, I'm aiming to try and get to a sort of natural stopping point and send it all down at once. And cause it's probably going to require taking it all down in person. I don't know what kind of conversations to get it into the collection, but no, I absolutely do want to get the songs in there. And I've recorded interviews with the folk singers that are still alive that I can contact, and those interviews hopefully will become part of their collection as well. Eventually I do hope to use those interviews as the basis of a book on the topic of folklore within the folk song within the county. I don't have a time scale for that, because it's when I get through with all the folk singers, and unfortunately I can't control their schedules and when they're happy to speak to me.
Oh yeah. I understand. Okay. And then Unorthodox Normie says, I'm from Staffordshire. The local council have announced they will shut the local museum and the small theatre due to funding, but meanwhile they're filling the hotels up with their migrants again. I think this is probably a common problem. Talk about that.
That's absolutely right. I think I mentioned it previously. I said about the Cannock Chase Museum being closed. They say it's due to funding problems because their budget has only grown by 15% when inflation over the last decade has been 40%. But closing these things doesn't make up for that shortfall. It's less than a quarter of the budget deficit. So I don't know what they're intending to do to get the rest of it. And to a larger point, yeah, they have filled, there's a large hotel in Cannock that's been filled with asylum seekers for a few years now. I'm not sure if they're still there. They say that they get funding from that from the government, so that's separate. I couldn't comment to that. What I can say is that they received a large bunch of funding from the government's Levelling Up scheme to renew Cannock Town Centre, and that was supposed to include a cultural hub, and the museum and the theatre were going to be part of that cultural hub when it was agreed, and that's what was announced when the funding was given. And then a couple of years later they've just gone, yeah, sorry, we're not going to use the funding for that anymore because it doesn't quite cover it or something. It's an absolute disgrace. At the end of the day, it's just the people of the council have no interest in it. They're looking at this from a financial perspective and what they're legally obligated to provide. So, yeah, for them, it's an easy decision. We're going to close it. We don't care about the people of the area and how they see their history, so it's going to go. Luckily, it's not going to go in the bin. The council do have an obligation that anything in the collection of the Museum of Cannock Chase has to be handed over elsewhere to people that are going to take care of it. I imagine some of that is going to go off to the Stafford Museum, and some of it is going to go to the Black Country Museum. Some of it might go out of county, though. But it just diminishes us. As a person who lives in Cannock Chase, you shouldn't have to go to the opposite end of the county to look at items related to your own history. It's absolutely abominable. And it's going to happen everywhere else, because eventually there's going to be questions over the Stafford Museum or the Black Country Living Museum. These things are just going to go more and more centralised until it's all just down in London, presumably.
Or in Brussels.
Oh, God.
God forbid. Okay.
And every time they move it as well, there's a chance they'll lose some or damage some.
Yes.
Something else as well with the Cannock Chase Museum. I said before, the collection's not digitized, meaning that you can't search the catalog on the internet, which is something very useful that I do with other archives in the area. They have been given funding again by the lottery to digitize that collection, but the work's not going to be completed until the end of 2025. But they're due to close at the start of 2025. So the digitization is not going to be completed. And that funding, whatever's left of it, is just going to go back to the lottery, presumably. So they've been given the money to protect this heritage and to document it. And because the council wants to save money on the actual building itself, that's not going to happen now. And the money's just going to get sent back. I think that's absolutely disgraceful.
Yeah, there's no other word for it. It's just outrageous. I don't know what to say.
Sorry,
my blood boil.
I'd love to come on here and be the white pill stream, but it doesn't feel like that a lot of the time when you're talking about buildings and heritage. The white pill is hopefully more people take an interest from hearing things like this and think, you know what, I can have a go at that. And we'll start to see more things pop up. If anyone wants to start another folklorist channel or project for another county, get in touch with me. I will help you, I will teach you, and I will promote you as little as I can. I will do anything I can to help anyone else who wants to do a local project.
Okay, great. There are some other super chats. Anti Matoid says, great show and excellent guest, thank you very much. And Enlightened Despot says, the transformation of the West since the 60s has been the problem our cities and culture were documented in photograph and film. This is very inconvenient, as it shows how better things used to be and the beauty of our cities. It's inevitable that they go after this by erasure and alteration to end the memory of it. I think this relates to what you were saying about AI being used to create fake history and alter photos and so on. This has been a thing that people have said before, that a problem that the multiculturalists have and the globalists have is that we have all the documentary evidence of how things used to be. It's a real thing. And I think part of if this all continues, then what they'll start to do is just inject fake, falsified stuff into that body of evidence. To create a distorted version of history. I mean, it's disgusting, but I think they will do it because their ideology sort of really forces them to do it. They don't have much choice but to do that in order to maintain the lie.
If they hope to build any sort of narrative about these communities being here in the past, AI is the only way to go. AI and just gaslighting the public that things aren't the way that their grandparents remember.
Yeah, or even that we remember. Yeah. I mean, it's not just our grandparents, yeah. Darby says, the YouTube channel Bedtime Stories has produced some decent content related to British-style folklore, although it mostly consists of ghost stories. Are you familiar with this, Bedtime Stories?
I'm not. I'm probably going to go look it up. And I'm all for the ghost stories. Those absolutely are a part of folklore. It's just not the totality of it. But I'll go look it up and I'll see what I think. If it's if it's based in reality or if it's things that have been developed for entertainment, shall we say?
Yeah. Okay. And then the Woodlander. Hello, Woodlander. He says, he asks, is there new folklore, tales and history being created? And I think you've addressed that already. Yeah, do you want to take that?
Yeah, again, as sad as it sounds, I think for the moment, the folklore that's being developed is kind of stories of people as told through the internet, which is kind of fitting considering that's where we live our lives at the moment. I really want to get away from that. I want to get people back into little communities that can separate from the mass media a little bit, and we can start creating new folklore of our towns and communities that isn't related to the digital age. That's a long-term goal.
Okay. All right. Well, this has been excellent. And I think a lot of people have enjoyed it. So thank you very much for agreeing to appear. I think this has been a really useful stream, a practically useful stream. And I hope that at least some people will be inspired by it and get into this. As I say, I can say this with a clear conscience because I've got into it in my own way over the last year. And so I can tell you it is absolutely a rewarding thing to be involved with. So, okay, Staffordshire Folklore, thank you for appearing on Millennial X.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Okay. I'll be back soon with Rusty McCrusty, I believe, and I'll see you then. Bye-bye for now.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial, but how about giving something back to your tireless host? Bitcoin, Ethereum, Monero, and other cryptocurrencies are all very welcome. Get the info you need at millennial.com/crypto and make your donation today. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him to keep the lights on.